From KUAZ Radio in Tucson, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, a report on some possible changes to the visa program, which could bring more foreign-born workers to Arizona's high-tech businesses. A look at the endangered languages of the world and work being done at U of A to preserve them. The Tucson Weekly is urging their readers to run for our nation's highest elected office, and we'll find out more about Project White House. And learn more about VEME, the new Spanish-language public broadcasting network, now available in Tucson. That's all coming up next, here on Arizona Spotlight. Since September 2001, the number of H-1B visas, which are the visas issued to foreign workers with specialized skills, has diminished, down from almost 200,000 to just over 60,000. This has created a void for some high-tech businesses in Arizona, but Christopher Conover reports next on a plan that could help with the manpower shortage.
The H-1B visa is a temporary work permit allowing U.S. companies to employ people with specific skills like engineering and science. Bob Breaux is the chairman of Breaux Research, a Tucson-based company specializing in optics and engineering. He says the H-1B visa system needs to expand because right now he has five positions he can't fill.
We need employees, high quality, highly trained employees. Those who come from foreign countries who are the best and the brightest minds, we want to keep them. And we don't pay, you know, minimum wage. We pay the going rate. These are expensive people, but we need them if we want to compete on a global scale. We're competing with brain power, innovation. We need the brightest and greatest people. So if they've come here, they're interested in staying, we want them.
Bro says he would be happy to hire U.S. citizens. The problem is his industry is growing so quickly that the universities can't graduate students quickly enough to fill the gap. And that's why he needs to look to non-citizens for employees. He says adding to the graduation rate issue is the fact that many university graduates aren't U.S. citizens.
If they get a degree, you know, in these areas, and they're the brightest and greatest people in the world, automatically, you know, hey, you're welcome. We would love to have you. We need to change our attitude that, you know, we want these people because the people who are already here and have been here, they're already bright and they know how to compete. And they have learned the competitive American system and they can bring it home.
The universities are aware of the problem. At the University of Arizona, which has one of the largest colleges of optical sciences in the nation, Will Rivera says the need for optics workers is so high that upon graduation, students are all but guaranteed a job. However, when it comes to foreign students, it's a balancing act.
We try to limit how many foreign students we have because we want to make enough students available to organizations who need U.S. citizens working within their facilities. A lot of what we do is defense related, and so the issues with defense and security are very important right now. And so I think that's really where we start to look at sort of balancing how many of these foreign students we want who will ultimately hopefully become productive people in our society, but at the same time we also want U.S. citizens graduating from the program so that we can supply the U.S.-based corporations.
Against the business and academic backdrop, Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords is hoping to make a change to the H-1B visa program. She's drafting legislation to double the number of available H-1B visas and uncap the exemption for graduates of U.S. universities.
We do hear from the universities, particularly with the PhD students who have done exceptional work in research and have a desire to teach, many of them, and you know the visas are simply not available. So at the University of Arizona and across the state and the country, we have to make sure that for the best and the brightest that are here, that have jobs available for them, that we keep them here.
In a discussion with optics industry leaders, Congresswoman Giffords said the current situation is a brain drain. The U.S. educates foreign-born students, and then domestic companies are kept from employing those students due to the visa restrictions. so the students go home.
This H-1B visa reform is about capturing the best and the brightest worldwide. Those students that that are graduating in these fields where currently we don't have U.S.-born students, and pulling from the best talent. I mean, we are a country of immigrants, and we're great because we have diversity in our culture, diversity in our backgrounds, but by capping at 65,000 the H-1B visas, basically capping our ability to continue to lead worldwide.
Gifford says new federal law will encourage more U.S. students to enter the sciences, so eventually the number of available domestic workers should increase. But in the meantime, the foreign workers are needed. Each year when the application process for H-1B visas opens, all available spots are spoken for within 24 hours. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Christopher Conover.
On our planet, experts estimate that one spoken language is lost every month when its last known speaker dies with no one left to pass it along. Next, we hear from Tony Paniagua as he looks at work being done at the U of A to preserve and record endangered languages.
Hundreds of millions of people around the world speak English, and new students are learning it every day. But other languages are in danger of being lost forever, and experts are concerned.
Which means I told the kid to go.
Even though a few thousand residents in Mexico speak Yaqui, the number in our state is significantly lower.
In Arizona, it's fewer than 100 people are left that speak the language within Arizona. In fact, every time an elder dies, the Yaquis have a custom of keeping a book of the dead, so you can know exactly when a fluent speaker dies.
Heidi Harley is a linguist who specializes in Yaqui. She says several factors contribute to the loss of languages worldwide. The economy is one of the major ones. People learn the local dominant language for financial survival, to assimilate in the mainstream culture.
It's definitely a pressure, and without some kind of intervention or some kind of realization on the part of the people that they need to make an effort to keep the language, it will die.
But awareness is growing, and Joe Sanchez's experience is an example. Sanchez's Yaqui ancestors moved to California during the Great Depression. The language is no longer used in his state, but he hopes to bring it back to life by studying it in Arizona and Mexico. Sanchez is a master apprentice on the reservation.
This is very important to me because I believe language is identity. And with no sense of identity, there's really, there's no culture, there's no history. Most of our creation stories are done in the language. And without me knowing the language and the songs, I just don't feel that I have an identity, just learning the language just filled my whole being up with identity and confidence.
The new good takes care of us. Good, Maria?
Ofelia Cepeda has a different linguistic experience. She learned her native language from her parents, and now she teaches it at the University of Arizona.
My first language, Odom, is the language that I choose to talk about the world around me. It's not that it can't be done in English, it's just that it's wonderful to have that choice.
Lauren Harrison is a creative writing student who has taken several languages, including Japanese, French, and Navajo. Now she's in Cepeda's class.
I'm really interested in them because of a standpoint of being able to communicate with other people, and just learning languages enhances my own writing because you get to see different things in them that are so different from English, and it's just really interesting to see the progression of languages.
Here are estimates on the number of speakers of some of Arizona's Native American languages. The top three are Navajo with more than 100,000 people, followed by Otom at 11,000 and Western Apache at 10,000. The least common languages are Yavapai, Kokopa, and Yaqui, with about 100 speakers each. And Chemehuevi only has 4 speakers, all older residents in our state. Professionals say the death of a language is like losing a natural treasure that can never be replaced, a record of people and their view of the world. For example, when a woman speaks in Yaqui about her children, she uses a different word than her husband would.
So, for instance, a woman speaking of her child will say asoa, which is the word that refers to somebody who, the person who I birthed, right? A man speaking of his child will not say asoa, because of course he didn't give birth. So he has a word for daughter and a word for son, but they are neither of them referring to the birthing process.
In autumn, a language of the Sonoran Desert where water is scarce, the rain and clouds have a special significance.
So there, a person can look at, you know, clouds just starting to come over, you know, say the Catalina Mountains in mid-morning or something like that, and they can say something like Tkyochu, you know, it looks like it might rain, you know, and then as clouds come and get darker or something, then they talk about it in another way.
The future of languages like Yaqui and Na'atam remains uncertain, so teachers and students say it's imperative that they be supported, encouraged, and preserved. For KUAT, I'm Tony Paniagua.
We'll have more Arizona Spotlight coming to you right after this break. Are you looking for a change in career? Are you ready to break into the executive level? Can you take on a four-year commitment with long hours and lots of travel? And the Tucson Weekly is looking for people with fresh ideas to apply for the job of President of the United States, with an offer to help jumpstart some campaigns. It seems that almost anyone can put their name on the Arizona presidential primary ballot next February. I asked the Weekly's Jim Nensel to come by the studio to explain.
Project White House is an idea we came up with at the Tucson Weekly after we learned that to get on the presidential primary ballot here in Arizona in February, all you really have to do is fill out a form. There's no requirement that you gather signatures or pay a nomination fee or anything like that. So we thought, hey, why not invite all of our readers to go ahead and run for president and see who would respond to that?
If you end up with a lot of response to this idea, couldn't that end up cluttering the presidential ballot in February?
Well, that's basically the plan. We're certainly hopeful we can get 30 or 40 people running as Republicans and Democrats out there.
And why is the field limited to just Republicans and Democrats right now?
Well, unfortunately, if you're a Green or a Libertarian, you don't get a state-sponsored primary. That's just the way the statute works. Only Republicans and Democrats will be going out to vote in February's election.
And what about independents?
Well, independents are actually not allowed to vote in the presidential primary. They have to register as either a Republican or a Democrat in order to vote in this race. So if you're out there, you're an independent, and you're thinking, hey, I want to run for president and vote for myself, then you're going to have to re-register.
That is a key question, actually. How many people would, in fact, vote for theirself for president?
Well, I certainly would vote for myself if I were on the ballot. And you would think that anybody who's going to put their name on the ballot would expect that they would be the best man for the job.
You'd hope so. So, Jim, what sort of people do you expect are going to follow through here and try to set up a platform for their campaign?
Well, I imagine we'll have lots of uniters and not dividers out there who are eager to show that they've got the stuff to run this country. I mean, when you look around and you see what's going on in this country, I'm sure you've often said to yourself, hey, I could do a better job than these guys are. And so we're really looking for people who feel like they can step up and basically take the reins of this country and straighten out the mess that we're in.
Okay, so if you'd like to be a potential candidate for Project White House, how do people go about making that first step?
Well, we have the nomination form set up on our website. So you go there, you download the nomination form, and you fill it out, you send it into us, and then what we need from you also is a platform of some kind. It can be anything from a 250-word or less essay explaining why I want to be president right down to a 250-page political manifesto. We'll take a look at it. We're not guaranteeing we're actually going to read your entire manifesto, but we will take a look at what you have sent to us. And then what we're going to do is, if we decide you're newsworthy, then we will go ahead and cover your campaign. And we will also help you get your form notarized and sent in so that you will actually be on the ballot in February.
But what kind of things are you looking for in your potential candidates? When the manifestos come in, what sort of thing you think would catch your eye?
Well, you know, certainly if you send a photo of yourself standing in front of a flag, we're going to know that you're serious about this. I mean, that's the sort of thing, as we look around at the candidates out there. Yeah. Candidates seem to have these flags in the background. So that's a big deal right there. And then, really, we want to see some innovative and creative solutions to the problems facing America. And if you have those, then we're going to take a hard look at you, because basically we've got two grand prizes in this entire contest, and that's the Tucson Weekly endorsement for both a Republican and Democratic candidate.
Do you think that the Tucson Weekly's endorsement is a political plum?
Oh, absolutely. In a race like this, where you have 40 different candidates that the voters have to sort between, then the endorsement could make all the difference.
Are you planning a voter's guide to help people follow the candidates?
Well, that's coming up in the month of January, depending on, you know, what kind of response we get to this and exactly who falls onto the ballot. We will be covering the various campaigns, and we're hoping to be able to set up a Project White House website where we'll give you day-to-day reaction actions from our candidates on the various issues that are occurring throughout the month of January.
Well, I know I'll be looking for someone who's running a pro-cat platform. That's the fundamental thing that would get me interested.
Right. But then you're going to have the dog people on the other side of that. So,
did you do any research before this about what's required to get on the ballot in other states?
Well, we did look around a little bit. In New Hampshire, for example, it costs $1,000 to get onto their ballot. And they usually have anywhere from 20 to 30 people running in New Hampshire. So, it's a real bargain to do it here. And this contest is actually open to people across the United States. So if you're somebody who's living somewhere else and happen to hear this on the internet or get wind of it, then certainly you're more than welcome to go ahead and enter yourself into Project White House.
When you look at the presidential race for 2008 as it stands right now, what do you see?
Well, you know, Hillary's looking awfully good on the Democratic side. I think she's really got a campaign machine in place, and she's got this kind of aura of inevitability surrounding her, although it looks like Obama's making some traction over in Iowa, and a win there certainly punctures that whole idea that she is indefeatable. And so that's still a race. On the Republican side, though, I think it's a bit more of a muddle. I think there's a lot of different constituencies supporting a bunch of different candidates. And I've been talking to some folks who have suggested that you could have such a split among Republicans that that one could go all the way to the convention and actually be resolved at a convention, which would be changing it from the typical pageantry to something that's actually meaningful, which could be interesting, but I think that actually helps Democrats in the long run, because you have a divided party versus one that's uniting behind a nominee.
Once the Weekly finds its candidate, will you be offering them any backroom advice on how to go up against the political machines they'll face?
Oh, yeah. I think we'll be strategizing their entire campaigns, giving them all sorts of ideas of platforms and press conferences and attention that they're really going to need.
You got to have strategery.
Yeah, strategery is very important in these campaigns.
Why do you think that Arizona's presidential ballot is so easy to crash?
Because I think the lawmakers didn't really give a lot of thought to how to set up any kind of requirements when they created this. And it's a loophole that we are gleefully exploiting.
So, you know, when all is said and done, what would you really like to see come from the Project White House candidates?
Well, I'd certainly like to see our candidates win a few delegates here in Arizona, although I think that's very, very unlikely. Other than that, I hope that we at least bring a little bit more attention to the presidential primary process and help people sit up and pay a little bit of attention to what's going on out there.
Any other comments? Any other areas you think we should?
I would invite you to consider signing up Project White House, your opportunity to run for president and claim your place in history.
Hmm. I'll have to give it some thought.
The clock is ticking. You have until Friday, December 7th to sign up, and you can find details on our website, www.tucsonweekly.com.
That's barely enough time for me to set up an exploratory committee.
And get your fundraising underway, but you can do it.
You better hurry. As Jim said, the Tucson Weekly needs your campaign platform, along with pictures, rants, or any additional info you'd care to include, by midnight next Friday. That's December 7th. You can find the official entry form online. We've got the link up at KUAZ.org. And remember, the Arizona presidential primary is scheduled for February 5th, 2008. Public Broadcasting continues its commitment to diversity and to better serving its growing audience by launching VEME, a new Spanish-language network now available in Tucson from KUAT-TV. The network's president, Carmen DiRienzo, talks with Peter Michaels next about what viewers can expect from VEME and its programming.
Carmen DiRienzo, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Can you tell us what VEME is?
Yes. VEME is a brand new network. It's a digital network that is offered in partnership with public television stations around the country. And it's really very exciting because it's Public Broadcasting's initial effort to have a full channel dedicated to the Hispanic community. It grew out of the opportunity to have VEME actually grew out of the digital transition because public television stations had additional spectrum. And the desire to serve the Hispanic community was very great, particularly in communities like Tucson, where there is a large bilingual and Spanish-dominant Hispanic community that didn't previously have access to the kind of high-quality production in some of the genres that with which public broadcasting has so well served the general market.
And can you describe the programming that you're going to provide?
Absolutely. We like to call it the best of public television and more. The programming actually grows out of research that we did over 3 years about what was missing from the media landscape for the Hispanic community. And we came up through that research with four fairly strong responses. The first was children's programming. Prior to VEME, there was no daily block of preschool children's programming in Spanish. So in response to that observation, and especially given the experience of how well public television has helped to prepare children in the general market for kindergarten, we developed a 6-hour block that's offered every day, Monday through Saturday, of PBS quality kids programming that has been very well received to date. The second thing that we heard over and over in our research, which was done all around the country, was that there's really a paucity of in-depth public affairs in Spanish available, despite the fact that there are so many Spanish language channels. And so our prime time, similar to English language public television, has a fairly intense focus on public affairs. And we have a nightly, our signature program is a nightly interview program that offers an hour-long in-depth interview with newsmakers from across all segments, politics, journalism, entertainment, sports, etc. And another thing that we heard in connection with public affairs was people said, don't make this channel only about us. Yes, it's true. We have issues that are unique to the Hispanic community, and we need to know about them. But we live here. Mm-hmm. We're part of America. We're part of the world. And so in response to that, you'll see when you look at our schedule that there is a significant amount of global public affairs and additional interview programs that are designed to fulfill that need.
Produced from other countries?
No. We have our nightly program that comes, actually it's kind of exciting. It originally came only from New York. It was based in New York. Viva Voz is the name of the program. We now come from Washington one night a week, Viva Voz desde Washington. And we have taken the show on the road and will be continuing to do that throughout next year so that the program based in different communities around the United States can focus on newsmakers and people of interest in other parts of the country. We also have a series called La Plaza, which is hosted by Maria Hinojosa,
who many
of you know from public radio. And that program is produced in Boston. Again, it's an interview program with newsmakers. We are the exclusive presenter of Andres Oppenheimer, which is the premier public affairs program in Latin America. So that one is, you know, clearly imported. And then we offer adaptations of other programs that will be familiar to you, including Wide Angle and Exposé. And also, we have elements of Religion and Ethics News Weekly, which we call Creencias, where we have the opportunity to take some of the documentary segments and we rehost them and make them a bit more culturally referent.
And why now? I know service like this has been talked about for years in public broadcasting, but why now? Is it because the Hispanic population has increased so much?
It's a combination of reasons, Peter. The first thing, the thing that made it possible as a 24-hour network was the digital conversion, which happened for most stations around 2000. The importance of the Hispanic community and the opportunity to fill a gap in that media landscape, which we talked about a little bit before, was really the inspiration. I mean, public broadcasting has played such an important role in really maximizing the value of media by making TV time meaningful. There is this huge population of soon to be 50 million Americans who don't have something similar. The important thing about our programming also, I mean, beyond some of the programming that we highlighted already, the programming is very entertaining. There is an additional focus on music and on Latin film, because although you may say, well, I can flip through the channels and see movies in Spanish, what you see are American movies dubbed in Spanish. What we offer are Latin film, which is a way of sharing Latin thought. And we offer closed captioning in English so that non-Spanish speakers can also enjoy those films and share that thought. We have several other programs for which we offer closed captioning in English, and we'll be working on more of that because the variety of viewers to whom VEME ultimately should be of interest are certainly native Spanish speakers, they are bilingual people, and they may be non-Spanish speakers because we reach 36.5 million general market homes, which is about a third of the country. We reach 5.2 million Hispanic TV households, which is about 42% of total U.S. Hispanic households. We are offered on both of the major satellite companies, DirecTV and Dish Network, as public interest programming. And we are partnered with 30 public television stations around the country and offered both over the air on those television stations' digital channels and on the cable companies that are in those communities.
Carmen, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.
VEME's programming is available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And you can find it on KUAT-TV's over-the-air digital channel 6-3, on Comcast cable channel 202, and Cox cable channel 81. Next, Arizona Spotlight's Kara Chesser brings us a look at some of the events happening around town this weekend.
Turkey leg, anyone? Wine and dine like a king or queen at the Rincon University High School's Magical Dinner. In addition to the dinner, choir members dressed in Renaissance attire will be there to serenade attendants. The dinners are tonight and tomorrow night from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Rincon University High School cafeteria. Also running this weekend is the 83rd annual Tumacocri Fiesta, featuring American, Mexican, and Native American foods and crafts. The fiesta runs all day tomorrow and Sunday at the Tumacocri National Historic Park. And tis the season to enjoy holiday events. Starting this weekend and running through December 23rd is the annual Zoo Lights at the Reed Park Zoo. Enjoy an evening walkthrough of the zoo decorated in holiday decor from 6 to 8 p.m. Also in the holiday spirit, Ballet Continental will perform a rendition of The Nutcracker tonight and tomorrow at 7 p.m. and Sunday at 2 p.m. at the Sal Rita High School Auditorium. Finally, holiday nights are back at Tohono O'Chul Park, where 500,000 lights and luminarias brighten up the park for the start of a holiday season. The event takes place tonight and tomorrow from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Kara Chesser.
That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. As always, thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio from the University of Arizona and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. The music heard on our program, including the theme, was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of our past shows, as well as podcasting of Arizona Spotlight, are available online at KUAZ.org. I'm Mark McLemore.